Hello, and welcome to the 11th Bad Idea Podcast. We are your hosts, Simon Abrams.
And Steve Carlson.
Carlson, that's right. And in case you're joining us for the first time, the podcast is dedicated to watching movies that, when grouped together, constitute a very bad idea. It's basically we're watching a lot of movies that are you wouldn't watch unless you're... What's the word?
Masochistic.
Adventurous is the word I choose, but sure, masochistic is a good one. Because in general, it isn't just to basically punish ourselves, it's to see if we can find anything of value. It's for talking points, because I like arguing with Steve, and it's hard to find someone good arguing with. And in general, you know, there's nothing more fun to argue about than bad movies, or movies by people that aren't quite all there, or just basically film topics that aren't necessarily the best that you can think of. So,
because anyone can have an opinion about Seven Samurai, but it takes a real man to have an opinion about Michael Winner.
Oh, yeah. And that, incidentally, is the topic of this month's podcast, Michael Winner, the filmmaker of such films as Death Wish.
The Sentinel.
Death Wish 2.
Death Wish 3.
And
The Mechanic.
The Mechanic, the original Bronson film, that is, not the shitty Simon West remake.
I would argue that. That the Simon West is a slight improvement, but whatever. It's still shit.
Okay, yeah. Maybe. But yeah, and several other films. But in general, Winner is a hit-or-miss filmmaker, I find. I am rather partial to The Sentinel, which seems to have every character actor under the sun and an incredibly flamboyantly gay Burgess Meredith performance.
Good God, yes. But we'll get to that.
What are we starting with?
Well, the theme specifically is... it was suggested to us by Matt Lynch,
yes.
As promised at the end of the last podcast.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you very much, Matt. The films that we watched were quite entertaining, in my opinion.
For the most part.
The idea is that he has grouped these three films together as sort of Winner's feminist trilogy. In that, you know, Winner...
Hold on. I automatically am skeptical of this idea because I didn't know that was what we were doing, but I knew it had something to do with feminism, but... We are talking about the filmmaker that did a film called The Girl Getters, yes?
And I do suspect that particular nomenclature has been added at least semi-sarcastically.
Yeah.
Especially after seeing these films, there's definitely an element of, oh yeah, feminism.
Yeah.
Especially in regards to the first film we're going to talk about, which is The Sentinel.
The Sentinel, yes.
Yeah.
The Sentinel was made in 1977. It's clearly a response to, like, a mishmash of... The Exorcist and Rosemary's Baby, and it's set in like a Brooklyn brownstone that is apparently a gateway to hell. And this woman, she's a fashion model. Who's the actress?
Adrienne something. I think she didn't go on to do much.
But yeah,
the Sentinel was kind of her. It's her major role. She also had a significant role in the American omnibus film Nightmares. Yeah. But beyond that, yeah, not a whole lot to her credits.
But yeah, she's basically a woman that is constantly trying to get
Christina Rains, that's her name.
Christina Rains. Okay, so her character is trying to fend off her boyfriend, who's a lawyer and is always wearing the same like double-breasted suit.
Oh shit, she's in Nashville.
Oh yeah, a little film called Nashville.
I guess that's significant, isn't it?
I guess. But yeah, so. She plays a fashion model, and her lawyer boyfriend's like, marry me, and she's like, no, I want my own apartment, which is convenient because the apartment that she winds up letting is haunted, and
it is
a gateway to hell, and no one has lived there for 3 years, and except for this person that, like, is blind and is always looking out the window because it's like a priest that's guarding the gateway to hell, which happens to be in Brooklyn. Although I'm not sure what part of Brooklyn is it supposed to be. I imagine it's in Dumbo.
Yeah, I don't know.
Because it's overlooking Manhattan. So I imagine it's somewhere near the Manhattan Bridge, presumably.
You'd be a lot better with the geography on that than I am.
Anyway, if it is Dumbo, I believe that, sure, there's a gate to hell there. Okay. But yeah, so she... Weird goings on, including like Germanic lesbians, and you know, in general, it's just very. It seems like it should be very boilerplate, and for some patches of the film, it is rather boilerplate supernatural stuff. But there's a lot of really kinky stuff going on in the background, too, that I rather enjoy. I enjoyed it a lot more the first time when I didn't know what the big reveal of the film was. Steve, what are you doing?
I'm checking the... I was just looking at the volume levels.
I think we're fine.
You think?
All right. I mean, look. Anyway.
Yeah, I was looking at those.
Yeah, whatever.
Anyway.
So, yeah, like, there's flamboyant Burgess Meredith, who's very gay and dead, and there's two Germanic lesbians that, like...
Spoiler alert!
Oh, whatever. I already established that she's the only tenant in this place.
Spoiler alert!
Fuck off. And, yeah, the Germanic lesbians are my favorite, because, like, she's in the apartment of their apartment, and she's like, so what do you guys do for a living? And one of them's like, fondle each other. And that's when, like, she's like, oh no, I can't be anywhere near these women.
Dun, dun, dun.
Like, they may turn me gay or something. Like, that's the thing. Like, and there's where some of the presumably interesting stuff that Winter does nothing with comes in. It's the idea that, like, she is afraid of queerness. She's afraid of sex. She's afraid of commitment to anything. She's afraid, basically.
Well, she's...
And, there's, like, certain standards of, like, otherness that she's okay with, like the gay fashion photographers, one of whom is played by a young Jeff Goldblum, and there's also the gay Burgess Meredith, who she defends to her boyfriend as being cute, and she likes him, he's not weird at all. But Germanic lesbians, that shit is not okay, because that they might fondle her, you know?
I think it's more a reaction to the fact that one of the Germanic lesbians, who is played by a young Beverly D'Angelo, in a reminder that young Beverly D'Angelo was one of the greatest things to ever walk this earth, fondles herself right in front of her, you know, without warning. Just, they're sitting here, she's waiting for
tea. What is she supposed to do, announce it? I'm going to touch myself. La, la,
well,
la,
how about
la,
not?
Get, what is this? What, she needs spoiler warnings for before she touches herself?
How about not Look touching out. Herself? How about not touching herself in front of the guests?
Yeah,
I'm just saying.
Right. What I was going to say, it's like... You gotta do something for your guests. Maybe she didn't have anything in the fridge. I don't know.
Entertainment?
Yeah.
Well, you know, ladies and gentlemen, by the way, yeah. Colleen, my wife.
Yes, I always touch myself for the benefit of my guests.
Sure, it's not unreasonable request.
But that's something else. But I don't know if it's not, okay. Let me start over. I just think what's kind of bizarre about this film is that, you know, the whole problem with it the plot basically jumps off from her wanting to be herself. Like, she doesn't want to be tied down, you know, she doesn't want to get married and conform to a traditional gender
role,
I guess.
She sure as shit does not want to be gay.
And she sure as shit does not want to be gay.
No gay.
No gay. /gay.
No gay in the way, hey, all right?
Okay.
Well, maybe she would want to be gay, just not with someone quite so Germanic.
Oh, and
we don't know.
The one that we skipped over, no homo, of course.
No homo. /gay. But then again, you look at her boyfriend, you know, Chris Sarandon with that fabulous little Latin lover mustache.
And his fucking two-piece suit. He's wearing it in every scene, which, well,
he
makes sense later.
He has 20 different suits.
And
they
all
look
the
same.
Yeah, exactly. But, it's a closet full of gray tweed suits.
He's like a character from The Simpsons.
Hey.
But what's interesting, you know, because the idea...
And he's got an apartment full of Houdini posters, which is another thing that I assume made more sense in the screenplay, or...
Yeah, I figured it was just one of those flourishes that you know, was nothing was ever actually done with.
I can totally see just, like, some poor unfortunate press guy just going, like, so what's with the Houdini posters? And, like, getting, like, a 5-minute answer that has, like, virtually nothing to what's on screen. Just like, you know, it's about escaping from one's expectations. I don't know why he's Italian.
I think Michael Winner's British.
He's Brit. It's about escaping from one's expectations. And it's all about femininity and the construction of gender. And
hello, I'm Michael Caine.
Hello, my name's Michael Winner. Not many people know that.
But, what's, you know, because, so, so you, you know, it could be seen as sort of a reaction against feminism. You know, like, all this terrible shit is happening because she moved into this apartment because she wanted to be alone. But yeah. Then if you look at – but then once the plot continues and you actually reach its end point, it's kind of like, well, maybe. But at the same time, it's not that she opened hell. She's the only one who can stop hell from opening.
Well, yeah, that's the recurring theme it seems to be throughout these films if you're going to look for one. It's the idea that the emancipated female is either psychotic or just, like, going to, like, regress to the point that, like, she'll, like – go back on her interest in ever being emancipated. It's like, I can be free, I can be an individual, and then eventually the world is just constantly going to remind her.
Nope, you're not free!
And the further we go in these films, the more you realize that, like, Winner is tacitly agreeing, like, yeah, she kind of shouldn't be free. Like, in The Sentinel, which is why it's the most palatable of the three, it doesn't have that stance, though. Like, it's totally a matter of she becomes a nun at the end. She becomes, like, a figure that, like, has nothing to do, like, categorically is pushing sex away from her, which is, I think, the only reason why religion has a role in this film, because she's so scared of, like, the horrors that have presented themselves over the course of the film to her. Like, sexual horrors, explicitly, like, stuff about the body in general.
And it could all be argued that it's an extension of her psyche. I mean, you know, look at the inciting incident in her, you know, her childhood, interrupting a satanic cake eating orgy with her dad, apparently, that drives her to go attempt suicide.
Black and white cat, black and white cake. Yeah. Anyway,
And before we go any further, I would just like to point out there is a scene in this that has a cat and a scarf and a party hat.
Yes,
If that is no other if you have no other reason to see this movie, you need to see it because it has Burgess Meredith dancing around a cat in a scarf and a party hat.
And the cat looks mad. Cat's just like
cat's like, what the fuck am I doing here? And the cat's named Jezebel.
Yeah, really,
Jezebel.
Oh my god,
because that's not loaded.
Yeah, but yeah. So what I find interesting though, like, is that Winner is obviously trying in some way to, like, talk about, like, fears of the body and, like,
comment on femininity and feminine roles.
Disfigured bodies, though. That's the thing. Like, that's why you needed, like, Winner actually had, like, freaks, like, actual carnival freaks at the end of the film show up and, like, present themselves as, like, haunted, basically ghosts that, like, haunt the building. And, like, in that sense, yeah, it's exploitative. It shows how tasteless Winner is, but on the other hand, like, it's the only trick he's got up his sleeve. It's the only time where he's gonna even obliquely show you that, like, hey, there's actually a critique here, even though it's half formed and doesn't make much sense beyond the fact that, like, well, wait, what does this have to do with sex, the body? Yes, but what is having carnival sideshow freaks have anything to do with being afraid of being turned into a lesbian or becoming married, or just, like, it's just too glancing of a commentary to wind up meaning anything. But it is the one point where he starts to, like, pull his shit together and be like, oh yeah, sex, fuck, I forgot. Thing.
And there's also the idea that, you know, Winner, let's be honest, Winner's not much of a thinking director. I mean, he's an into sensation and action, and most of his better-known works are very male-dominated, which is probably why these films were chosen for us, because they are in certain ways outliers in Winner's career.
Okay,
but yeah. So and he's also obviously very politically, he's definitely falls on the conservative side. I mean, the motherfucker made Death Wish, for Christ's sake.
Yeah,
which is one of the leading pro-gun arguments in cinema. And that's an interesting film, which I don't think we have time to get into.
Well, here's the thing, though. Like, the difference between Death Wish and Dirty Harry, for instance, is that when you, like, you, if you were to talk to Clint Eastwood, you would, or Siegel, for instance, maybe not Siegel as much, but Eastwood certainly, you'd get the sense that you're talking to a person with a fully fleshed out philosophy and, like, a sense of, why they are making such pictures as they are making, beyond, like, an innate sort of sense of entitlement. It's like, well, I feel this. It's like, why do you feel that? If you were to get that far with Eastwood, there'd be a cogent and intelligent answer. It'd be salty as fuck, but like you'd be able to respect it for its consistency. Winner is the kind of guy that would probably like take the argument in 3 or 4 different directions before settling on an answer that just sounds stupid.
Yeah.
And he's in that sense a provocateur. Retarded provocateur, I guess. I don't know. He's bad.
I'm Michael Winner.
Oh, my name's Michael Winter. I'm going to provoke you. And, like, but, I think that works in some regards, but, like, the utter humorlessness of these films, like,
well, I think
it eventually gets tiresome. Not in The Sentinel, certainly, but, like, later in... What are we talking about next?
Well, I actually wasn't done with The Sentinel. But, and I think I think that's actually where his films get interesting, in the space between the potential for the material and what he does with it.
Okay.
You know, his execution versus the initial material. Mm-hmm. I think there's generally a level where he's essentially fighting with the films that we're talking about. That he's trying to, you know, wrangle them into shape, as it were. And they aren't meant to be wrangled into Michael Winner shapes. Yeah, so he, you know, he just has to indulge the exploitative elements and rush through all the boring shit, you know. And I will say this about The Sentinel: The Sentinel is only the second film I'd seen from Michael Winner. The first was the original Mechanic, which I think is a fucking god awful film.
But more
to the point, I think it's a terribly directed film.
Sure.
Because if there's any auteur in the 70s who should not be pulling a Melville a homage, it's goddamned Michael Winner. Because he is not a patient director. He doesn't do well with space. He can't direct actors for shit. Which is why the Sentinel is probably the most interesting of his films that we've seen in terms of acting. In that he has so many established people he can lean on and just cut them loose and let them do their thing. Like,
but he's got a lot of people.
Meredith, he's got Ava Gardner.
But, I mean, on the periphery of this film are also, like,
I would just like to point out that this is the second film we've watched on this podcast that has Burgess Meredith showing up and hamming the fuck out of
Yeah, he's part. Also in The Manitou.
In The Manitou.
And, but yeah, the thing I would object to about your saying that, like, he already has established talent, but there's plenty of, like, faces that will become famous later, but in this film are definitely not established talent, like Jeff Goldblum, who has a very small part, but also Christopher Walken as, like, the...
Yeah, and he doesn't let Christopher Walken do anything.
Yeah, he does. He smirks a lot.
Oh, boy.
Well, it was funny. Because he's just like his Christopher Walken buddy partner is basically just, like, making these accusations to the main protagonist's boyfriend, and she and Walken's just there basically to, like, react and, like, be a dick and just be like, yeah, it's funny what my partner's saying. It's funny. And it's, like, it's basically all conveyed through, like, a smirk and a giggle. And, you know, it's the kind of role that Christopher Walken's face lends itself to very well.
Yeah, it's very much a reactive performance. But the detective, his partner is Eli Wallach.
Oh.
Yeah.
I totally didn't even realize that.
Arthur Kennedy shows up as the Monsignor. The priest upstairs, the blind guy, is fucking John Carradine.
Well, okay.
So yeah, so I mean,
he's Keith Carradine.
No, it's John.
Okay.
So he's got this huge cast that he uses as well as he can, I guess. But what I wanted to point out about this is, coming to this only knowing The Mechanic, I expected this to just be this flaccid, fucking boring thing, and it's honestly directed pretty well. I mean, it's especially in terms of the editing. I mean, the thing's cut to the fucking bone. Mm-hmm. It's put together like he didn't like Winter was watching it and didn't realize, I can't waste a frame with this ridiculous bullshit. This movie's so thoroughly ridiculous. I can't have people thinking about it. So let's just keep it moving. Push it. And yeah, it's like, if it were cut any quicker, it would be a fucking Russ Meyer movie. And I was kind of fascinated by that. And the film goes limp in the middle, I think, when Wallach and Walken show up and it turns into a police procedural that no one gives a fuck about for a while.
Right.
With, you know, this whole backstory with Sarandon and him killing his first wife, and or supposedly killing his first wife, possibly, maybe. And then it rallies for the finale with hell breaking loose and the freaks and all that. But yeah, so
I think that didn't bother me the first time I saw this film. When I rewatched it this week, I definitely felt the film lag there. But in general, it's the kind of movie that, like, my affection for it basically, like, if we were to use like a grade school scale, like, went from a B plus to a B, because, you know, I'd seen it before, but it's still like the kind of junk food I appreciated.
Yeah, it's certainly fun on its level.
Yeah,
but so.
What's next?
I believe we are jumping next to Scream for Help.
Scream for Help, which I like to describe as a Brian De Palma thriller if you excised all of De Palma's signature sense of, like, sarcasm and humor. And that's because, for the most part, it's a very histrionic film about a girl that is convinced her, and she says this in, like, very laden voiceover narration to begin the film, that she's convinced her stepfather killed her mother. And throughout the first half of the film,
or is trying to kill her mother.
I was trying. Sorry, yes. Yeah. And that's what I was thinking. But yeah, so in general, she's trying to get anyone to like believe that her stepfather is an evil bastard that's cheating on her mother, and like there's just all these scenarios where like she's trying to catch him in the act. She's trying to get evidence, and she's just like, "Why won't you believe me?" And everyone's like, "We don't believe you." And it's like, but how about now? We still don't believe you. And it's like, it's just like all this outlandish stuff, like including like full frontal nudity scene of like her stepfather having sex with someone,
railing this other chick. Yeah,
is it Brenda? Are we talking about Brenda? Yeah. This other woman named Brenda, who later in the film gets really jealous when he says that, like, this other woman makes better pancakes than her. And Brenda, through gritted teeth, is like, "How do you know? Ever taste my pancakes?" And anyway, so this is the kind of film that we're dealing with. But I think I compare it to De Palma because, like, there's clearly, like, a Hitchcock vibe that Winner's going for, except it's Hitchcock if you understand Hitchcock only through obsession. And, like, so basically remove.
It's second or third hand.
Yeah. And, like, so, like, there's a scene where the female protagonist is talking to her BFF, and they're, like, by the side of the road. It's like, "Oh, I'll always love you." And a car comes out of the, like, out of nowhere and, like, sideswipes one of the friends. And it's just, like, it's the kind of scene that, like,
my God, yes.
I
have my whole life ahead of me. And it's where she's and her friend has just announced that she's pregnant and is talking about getting an abortion.
Right.
Because she doesn't want to be tied down by a baby.
Right.
So I've got my whole life ahead of me. No, you don't.
Yeah. So, like, yeah, exactly. That kind of hysterical, like, moment in a De Palma film would be, like, played up, not necessarily for yucks, but, like, have, like, a vinegary sense of humor to it. And a very just bitterly sardonic sense of, like, "Oh, isn't this ridiculous?" Yes, but, like, it's kind of exquisite for that reason. It's kind of, like, shrill that it's beautiful.
Sort of like the car wreck and, like, the Fury.
Sure, or, like, almost any scene of violence and obsession. And, yeah, that to me...
The bitter ending of a Blowout.
Right, yeah, oh, yeah, oh, my God. The fireworks, yeah. But yeah, the what gets me about this movie is, regardless of intentionality, Winner is he's doing something similar to what he did in The Sentinel, but like it's about a girl this time that is deathly afraid of sex. So she like has all of her fears of sex on her stepfather, who is actually a sexual predator. And, like, it all culminates later when she's like, "I don't want to go to bed with anyone ever again."
And this is after she has just lost her virginity
to
a boy who was dating that friend of hers who got knocked up and then killed by the car. In fact, he's the one who knocked her up. Yeah. And then two scenes later, he's like, "Oh, I love you. And I love you. Let's go fuck. Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, ow, it hurts.
You're doing it wrong." And, like, yeah.
Wrong hole!
And, then, like, but, there's that level of, like, Babysitter's Club level critique
it's
of
this,
feminism.
It's this weird... there's this weird thing going on where, like, the first half of the movie is this like this TV movie level nonsense that keeps getting interrupted by these weird, inexplicably graphic curly cues, like, you know, like her spying on her stepdad, and, you know, we get full frontal nudity as
Beaver.
He's railing Beaver. Her from behind, or, you know, the post-virginity scene where she reaches down and, oh my god, she's bleeding. Or, she's running around with virginal blood on her hand.
One of, I think, the most awesome scenes in this film, though, is nothing that, like, explicitly tasteless, though, is the one where, like, she's just driving her car and it's like, look, oh no, the brake line's not working.
I fucking hated that scene.
I love it. I love it because, like,
it's just so hacktastic.
Oh, it's amazing. It's like, what are we going to do now? Like, pull over to the side. I can't. The wheel's locked.
It's like, it's just terrible. It's like, and I was so.
Take the key out of the engine.
I was so ready to give up on this movie at that point. I really was because that plus this god awful score by John Paul Jones. That just sounds like an outtake from the streets of San Francisco. it felt like the worst kind of fucking TV movie. And
the fuck off! You like Shadow Boxer?
That's because Shadow Boxer's legitimately nuts.
You're trying to tell? We've had this argument. The fact that it has like a TV made for TV aesthetic to it, though, and is
in
crazy.
in a certain aspect, yes, but.
I can't think of a made-for-TV movie that would just be like, break line cut, and just like spend like 2 or 3 minutes just having like a scene just like, I don't know what to do. That's awesome.
Oh, it's terrible.
Oh, it's so
but
much fun.
Anyway, it's what happens is that...
I don't want to go to bed with anyone ever again. Sorry.
But so you have this sort of, you know, this placid sort of generic thing that's being interrupted every now and then by these horribly tasteless flourishes. And then... the whole movie turns into that flourish. Like, randomly, the film just suddenly becomes a home invasion thriller. Where after the guy gets caught fucking his mistress by the teen, he suddenly realizes, oh, I've got to get this thing done, because it turns out he's married this woman for her money.
Yeah, but honestly, I think that, like, you're ignoring the obvious. Like, you're saying that it's being interrupted by these flourishes. But those flourishes are just, like, if you were to take this movie at face value, which I don't recommend doing, but for the sake of argument, like... those flourishes only periodically intrude on the film because it's still basically about a girl who's, like, trying to hold on to, like, or trying to reestablish a sense of order to her life. So, like, the fact that, like, periodically something violent happens to stop that shows you that, like, oh, shit, you can't do that if you go on this road and start pursuing the stepfather and start trying to, like, basically get people to recognize, oh shit, sex is scary and evil and deep and the woods are lovely, dark, and deep and I don't want to do that shit and blah, blah, blah. And that's...
yackety-schmackety.
Yeah, yackety-schmackety. And it's just like, yeah, it's in that sense, yeah, it's going to only periodically happen and only going to really go consistently or, according to you, consistently crazy at the end when...
The mom's wheelchair's flying around everywhere and... yeah, there's people stroking ketchup bottles suggestively, and
the pancakes line is great.
The pancakes line. Oh.
Ever taste my pancakes?
It's a man wants the girl to cook for him. Let her do it.
Yeah, really.
I
had fun.
Yeah, I did eventually end up having fun. It finally cuts loose, which I was waiting for. Yeah,
I guess it just gets kind of like when you have like the characters, like the evil wolfish sexual predator character is just like prowling around. That to me gets a little less interesting because like it's all just laid out on the line and you're sort of expecting it by that point. So I guess I want to say that I prefer the first half in a certain way because like by that point, like. It's just like, oh, things are happening, la da da da. Oh my god, brake line. Oh my god, kid gets hit by a car. Oh my god, full frontal. Like, it's just like that kind of like violent jerkiness to it is you know, I think appealing and certainly sells me on the bizarre hysterical tone of the film more than anything else.
I just see it as constant reminders that, hey, you could be watching a more interesting film right now. Let's show you excerpts from what this film could be if we gave a fuck. And then they start giving a fuck. Mm. But, and I do have to point out that the actress in this is, the lead actress is absolutely god awful. And she was all
the mother?
No, the teen, the chick. She's terrible in this movie. She was the reason I was having a lot of trouble getting into it too. I
mean, oh.
She has this bit at the beginning where she, you know, she's like comes downstairs and her stepfather's up and he lights a lighter and he's like hi, like a very creepy wolf sort of intro. And then he turns on the lights, and she was like, "What were you doing down there?" Because she's already convinced that he's getting ready to kill them. And he was like, "Oh, I was in my study." And then she turns around, to look at the study, and she whips her hair, and it's this blatantly false kind of turn, like, "Oh, a very stagey, like, oh, I'm supposed to turn this way now. Wait, but there's nothing over here. I'll turn back."
Right.
It's like you can actually see her thinking out her actions, and it's just. I mean, this is what I'm talking about when I talk about Winter being really, really bad with actors. And I think it does hurt his films to a certain degree.
I don't remember thinking that moment stood out to me because, in general, I wasn't really watching it for performance. Like, it didn't – even with that in mind, like, I still just didn't find it that bothersome because even if you aren't watching something for performance's sake, like, something that glaring – As something as glaring as you're describing probably would distract me, but I don't know why, it just didn't bother me.
Nah. And I would also like to point out that right at the end of the film, when a certain character gets electrocuted, her hair does that bzzz, the big poofy bzzz thing, like there's a wind machine at her feet or something, and it's the exact same look that someone has when they get electrocuted in Winter's Death Wish 2. So I just wanted to mention that. I think that's an interesting
continuity.
Conceptual continuity, baby.
Hey. So we're doing.
I think we're moving on to Dirty Weekend, which would be the third of the films in which women learn to stand up for themselves, or some shit like that,
or try to stand up.
Yeah, I was gonna say no women try and stand up for themselves in The Sentinel, and they certainly do. There are certainly there's a teenage girl who stands up for herself and screams.
They're all basically in these first two movies. Standing up for yourself is a very hollow victory.
she even says there's where her mom says there's no way out, and she says there's only one way. I'm gonna have to kill them. Bum bum bum.
Yeah, I guess these girls are like the Sentinel is like it shows you that like women that seriously try to go after their own independence wind up having to sacrifice part of their identity to do it. Scream for Help is a bit more generic in the sense that there is a possibility of a happy ending.
Girl power.
And
a Dirty Weekend is the
back to the psychotic.
I was going to say it's the end game there. It's like standing up for yourself will lead you down the road of psychosis.
Yeah, especially if you're a woman and you're trying to get over the fact that even though on the
a one man side, just cheated on you.
Yeah, like
that's really all she's getting over.
Well, that's the thing, like what's interesting here is that Winter's trying to have his cake and eat it too, in the sense that he's trying to show that he sympathizes with his female protagonist, in that like at every turn there's like a fucking parade of guys telling her, "Oh, look at all the numerous ways that we're assholes. Look at like it's in our DNA to basically be sexist pigs and like
try and mouth rape you, for instance."
Yeah, and like there's just every guy that she meets
is a rapist, yes.
Is a rapist waiting to happen. And it's just like, it's because Winter's making some very labored point about how, like, all men are scum and all men have that potential to basically be, to take advantage of women, blah, blah, blah. But at the same time, he's sort of saying that, like, yeah, this woman's crazy.
Feminine sexuality is scary, yo.
Yeah, it will turn you mad. And, like, the woman, there's no question as to the insanity of this woman because, like, she starts singing to herself.
The Hammer Song! I love the Hammer Song!
It's, she, after she murders her first victim, she's like, starts singing.
Dancing around his kitchen covered in blood, singing a song about killing people with hammers.
It's not even a good dance or song.
I want the Hammer Song to be my new ringtone. Somebody work on that for me, please.
It's clearly, like, for me, like, the kind of thing that, like, it, as filmed, it seems like the kind of thing that the actress just started to ad-lib, and Winter's like, no, don't cut yet. She's going somewhere. And it's like, she's not going anywhere.
Yes, she is. She's going into brilliance!
Hey.
As you can tell, I liked this film a lot more than Simon did.
Oh, it made me want to kill everybody.
It made me want to hug everybody.
Die.
And that Victor Morton was nice enough to suggest that we could compromise and I could hug people and then Simon could kill them while I'm hugging them.
Oh. Victor's a real great communicator. He's a real mediator. But in general, I find this movie repugnant because wanting to have your cake and eat it too is generally not something new here. But the fact of the matter is, like, trying so hard to, like, speak out of both sides of his mouth really has turned Winner into, like, someone that I just can't stand. If you're going to be sleazy, be sleazy. If you're going to try to make a concentrated effort to make a feminist statement, make The Sentinel. At least be consistent in, like, the story you're trying to tell. Like, the only times where, like, he undermines his own story in The Sentinel is by having actual freaks come out. And even then, it's sort of like, well, he just went overboard but at least he's going overboard in the same direction that he's been going thematically throughout the film. Mm. The fact that the body is horrifying and scary and weird. But here, it's just sort of stupid.
I got a lot of giggles off this. You're right. It's offensive and stupid and nasty and mean and for no reason at all other than, well, why the fuck not, you know? Sure, feminism and
girl power.
Girl power, all men are evil. Whatever. But I get the feeling Winter's taking this about as seriously as he takes the surprise film we're going to talk about. Because
surprise!
There is a surprise film coming up because we do like to have four films to talk about for every topic. And I thought it would be interesting as sort of a diametrically opposed film. But we'll get to that.
He needed one, but yeah, go on. Yeah.
But I think he's taking this about as seriously as he's taking that other movie. Which is to say, not in the fucking slightest.
But that's the thing. I don't consider that to be a merit at all, because the film, as in the film we're talking about, the film's tenor is essentially serious as a heart attack.
I don't find this movie serious at all.
It's not a film that you can half-ass. You have to be committed to this premise because it's so over the top. If you're not going to bother to do that and you're only just like, ah, this is silly, then why fucking make it?
We are talking about a movie where the female protagonist gets an obscene phone call and breaks down. This is like her breaking point, where she's like, I thought, you could hear in her voiceover narration, I thought you could be gentle in the jungle.
Hey.
And it immediately cuts to a steam kettle whistle.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't tell me he's taking this movie seriously.
I can, in the sense that if it were, and you're basically arguing that, like, the actions define the context here, whereas for anyone other than Winner, I would argue, yes, that action is inherently ridiculous, therefore Winner can't be taking himself seriously. But it's Michael Winner, the guy that directed The Mechanic. Of course he's taking himself seriously.
But this is Michael Winner 20.
You're talking that scene where in Scream for Help where the girl, you could see her thinking. I can see Michael Winner thinking in that scene that you just described as saying, oh yes, this will establish how frayed her nerves are. I can see him thinking that.
I just think this film goes so far over the top that it loses any claim it had to seriousness. I mean, every man in the film is rape happy. It's like a sort of distaff version of Ms. 45, except without the muteness and actual rape. All the rape in this is until you get to the scene with David McCallum in the parking garage. All the rape in this is verbal.
But there's
all threats and verbal molestations and things.
But there's no joy in this movie, Steve. I can't get behind ridiculousness that's not fun. It's just punishing, and it just won't take it anymore. I won't take it. You can't make me.
I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it a lot, and I don't care. I don't care if it's not.
I'd enjoy watching like all of Ulrich Seidel's films back to back to back to back to whatever.
That's pretty more. Rough.
Yeah, that's yeah. I'd go away with a happier fucking grin on my face than after watching this poop. It's poopy!
It's certainly unpleasant, I will say that, but I enjoyed it because I'm a sick fuck, apparently.
Whatever. Whatever gets you through the day.
Whatever gets you through the night. It's all right.
I have no idea what he's doing. Anyway, so, time to reveal the mysterious fourth entry in the Michael Winner Likes Women But Not That Much series.
I suggested this film partly because I know its reputation and I wanted an excuse to finally get around to watching it, and partly because it seemed like precisely the antithesis of any sort of feminist statement.
Well, any ist statement in general.
Any statement, period, really. But yeah, it's pretty much the knee plus ultra of brainless 80s cinema. And in case you haven't figured it out yet, we are talking about Death Wish 3.
Woo!
Which is just a masterpiece of idiocy.
Woo!
Because I hadn't seen any of them, I actually went ahead and watched all three of the first three Death Wish films in one night.
You poor fool!
And you can actually see the devolution. It's like the first film is like, it's you know, a fairly serious-minded attempt to make a straight-up urban revenge film.
Yeah.
Filtered through a Western, like literal Western, like, you know, cowboys and Indian sensibility.
Well, yeah, but why else hire Bronson?
Yeah, well, Bronson, and the urban jungle and, you know, that whole bit at the end where he's like, fill your hand.
Oh, gosh. Yeah.
And then the second one is like in the 80s.
Second one, mind you, is the first one scored by Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin.
Yeah, the
not another Jimmy Page.
The first death, and he got that gig because he was a neighbor of Michael Winner.
I can just see it. He's just like, oh, hey, Jimmy, I got this movie I want to make. Hold on a second. What? I'll take your money, sure.
But, and the first one was scored by Herbie Hancock, which the score's terrific. The score in the second film is not so terrific. Jimmy Page.
The third one is...
The score in the third one is abysmal.
Yeah, and it's clear,
it's
like...
It's fucking cocktail lounge music.
You could tell that Page was, like, at some point, like... thinking about this, but not his, he wasn't into it. He was thinking about how to do the score for this film. But after a certain point, he's just like, fuck it, I'll just repeat myself because I'm sick of this film. I just want my check. I want to go home. I want to sacrifice a virgin in my basement with my band because damn it, I'm in the fucking the guy from Led Zeppelin. Come on.
I shouldn't be scoring Death Wish 3.
Fuck. This movie has Alex Winter in it. Leave me alone.
It has a scene where Bill Preston, fucking
Esquire,
menaces Deanna Troi.
Whoa.
Yes!
This is a movie that is so, like, just totally listless that even Bronson's not into it. There are certain scenes where, like, especially where he's talking to, because the whole plot revolves around Bronson comes to New York. He meets up, he's supposed to meet up with a friend who winds up getting murdered by a gang leader who's like a crazy Aryan. Because, of course, he's a crazy Aryan. He's in New York. And,
he's a crazy Aryan who shaves only the middle of his head.
Oh, yeah. So it's like the anti-Mohawk or something. And, so Bronson is talking to, like, the neighbors of his dead friend. And, like, he's clearly not interested in the material. He's just like, hey, yes, I'm glad you knew my friend. Bob.
and Bronson, at least according to the Internet Movie Database trivia section, which we all know never lies.
Of course.
Bronson, while the kind of guy who didn't usually talk about his projects, had a lot of not nice things to say about this movie and didn't really like it and was put off working with Michael Winner ever again, even though he'd worked with him 6 times in the past. He just had a really terrible time making this movie.
Why?
From at least what I can glean, he definitely had some issues with a lot of the violence, presumably some of the inserted violence involving the gang extras that he wasn't there for. A lot of reshoots apparently went on the film, a lot of the second unit stuff.
It shows, especially during the final climactic fight.
Oh God, yeah. Every sequence with Bronson seems like it's taking place in another universe.
Yeah.
He's running around this one neighborhood with a fucking Browning submachine gun.
Yeah.
Incidentally, this film is beholden to the laws of logic as a Looney Tune cartoon.
Right.
This film was basically where everyone sat around, looked at the material, and went, "Fuck it, we're making a comedy."
Yeah.
Don't even bother. Don't ask me why we're doing this. There's money to be made, and fuck it, it's ridiculous.
It's the old, sure, old people versus punks who are refugees from fucking Cobra. Whatever.
It's like if you were to take, like, if someone had read A Contract with God or any, like, other Will Eisner story about, like, growing up in a Bronx tenement and just was like, yeah, and there are predators out there, and they're all evil, and they're immigrants mostly, and there's lots of white people, and
they're all old white people, and the police are taking their guns away!
And, yeah, that's what kills me, is that, like, these poor, like, Jewish tenants of this tenement building are, like, wringing their hands, and, like, Bronson's like, I'll save you from these people.
And Winter is determined to let us know that these people are Jewish, incidentally.
Oh, yeah.
When we're introduced to one couple, there's a giant menorah in the foreground.
And when he has them, they have him over for dinner after installed, like, a...
Do I smell cabbage?
Yeah. Something smells delicious here. Of course we're serving cabbage, and, you know. And it's like... It's just, it's so ridiculous. Like, they're eating, and he's, like, installed, like, a spring-loaded floorboard that has, like, a nail in it. And
what,
like,
are those?
What are these here? Teeth. And it's like, it's so repugnant.
Oh, but it's hilarious.
It's funny. That one's funny. That's one's repugnant in a funny way.
Yeah, Death Wish 3 is, that's the thing. Death Wish 3 goes so far over the top, and it's, I can't even call it ideology, because, I mean, I guess you can
and
get...
And it's lack of an ideology. It's moral bankruptness.
It's posing as having an ideology, as a sort of, you know, pro-America, you know, take our country back kind of thing, but it doesn't care.
Somewhere, like, Rod, what's his name, the guy who directed the Straw Dogs remake?
Rod Lurie, yeah.
Somewhere he was like, yeah!
But, yeah! It hedges its bets by making the gang multi-ethnic, of course, because, you know, you don't want to actually offend people, right?
Right, yeah.
You know. And, you know, Martin Balsam's running through it, trying to recover what's left of his dignity, and Bronson shoots the Giggler!
Not the Giggler!
They killed the Giggler!
They had no call to do that.
It's just, oh my god, it's such a ridiculous and amazing movie, and...
It was fun.
There's rape and murder, and it's a fun time for the kids, is what I'm saying.
Yeah, take the kids, take your grandparents, take strangers you don't know off the street.
Yeah, just to show them the magic of Death Wish 3.
Yeah,
they'll appreciate it. It's a beautiful movie.
Fun for all.
If it had a face, I would kiss it. I'm just saying, guys. I mean, there's rocket launchers and machine guns and Tenements blowing up.
And a total waste of Jimmy Page and Charles Bronson.
And Martin Balsam in a Brooklyn Dodgers baseball cap going, that's my shop! That's my shop! That's my shop!
Moral bankruptcy.
because everything we watch, everything we usually watch of this series is so not morally bankrupt.
Well, this one makes a big show of its morality.
Black Devil Doll from Hell is totally not morally bankrupt.
Can we talk about that movie now?
Yeah, you like that, don't you, bitch?
Wake up, bitch! Anyway, so I think that's our cue to end our discussion of Mr. Michael Winner and move on to our Netflix grab bag segment.
So, to sum it all up.
Yes, go on.
Michael Winner is a terrible director, and I kind of adore him now.
Michael Winner, name misleading.
Like a loser in a Michael Winner script.
Aye.
Thank you, Carter the Unstoppable Sex Machine.
Yeah. Thank you.
Haha, I just made a reference that Simon doesn't understand. Woo!
Why is that so rare?
Shut up! I'm celebrating my victory!
Yeah. Anyway, so this is the segment that we like to call the Netflix grab bag, where we switch off between Steve and mine's Netflix queue. And every month we ask you, the listener, to choose one of four titles that we randomly select from our respective queues and ask you to vote and have us watch a film. Because in general, when it comes to Netflix, our problem as being like very anal, voracious film goers is somewhere Victor Morton is sniggering at that. And anal and voracious. Get it? Anyway, So, yeah, we have a hard time, like, feeling like very excited about like movies that we have in our queue. It's like, when am I ever going to like feel so excited about having added like half the movies I've had in my queue for forever? And they never get watched, and you're kind of curious about them, but you need that extra push to basically watch them. And that's the idea behind the grab bag for us. It allows us to get movies that we wouldn't ordinarily like watch seen. It allows us to get them seen, and it potentially provides you the service of like hearing about movies that you've either already heard about and want to know from a different slant, or like movies that you haven't heard of and you're just like, hey, what's this about? And I think that's the latter category that the film we're about to talk about falls under. It's a 2005 film from Japan called The Man Behind the Scissors, directed by Toshiharu Ikeda, the director of he only actually did one movie that people might know, and that's Evil Dead Trap.
Yeah, I think he also directed one of the All Night Long films.
Oh, he did?
I think so. I'm pretty sure. Let me double check that, but I'm pretty sure he did.
Yeah, Ikeda is not a big player in Japan. He's not like a guy. He's not even a big cult figure. Apart from Evil Dead Trap, he's just
He also passed away a couple years ago.
Oh, well, there you go. That's why he'll never be a cult figure. Well, because he can't. No, wouldn't that make him more of a chance to be a cult figure because he's dead?
You would think, right?
So there are people be like, no, Evil Dead Trap is a misunderstood masterpiece. Arr! Anyway, The Man Behind the Scissors is not a misunderstood masterpiece because...
Oh, he also did XX Beautiful Prey.
Oh, sure. That.
Just out of curiosity, can we continue to talk about other films he did instead of this piece of shit?
Yeah, Man Behind the Scissors...
He did Angel Guts Red Porno.
I've heard of that, actually.
Yeah, I think Synapse released it.
That's why. Okay. Anyway, so...
Yeah.
Man Behind the Scissors is a pretty sedate, consistently sedate, like, serial killer thriller procedural thing where it's, like, its plot is split into two. It's basically you're following the Scissors Man or the Scissors Killer, this serial murderer that goes around with, like, his pixie-ish girlfriend, younger woman. And he's been set up. He is a murderer that kills people with scissors. And someone is copying him. And they have to find out who. And the police, likewise, and the other plot are trying to do the same thing. Now, I'm not sure if it's intentional or not. I'm sure after a certain point it is. But the police are very buffoonish. And this plot line is so with the police is so boring in that, like, whatever the serial killer and his girlfriend or his... You know, familiar, however the hell this girl is to him. Whatever they just figure out, the police figure out right afterwards.
No, it's not usually right afterwards. It's about 20 minutes later.
Yeah, and it's not even in a compelling way. It's not even like, oh, well, how did they get to the same place? Like, there just doesn't seem to be a reason why we're following the police beyond the fact that, oh, gosh, there's a twist coming up. And I won't even say anything beyond that because, like...
I would just like to point out that the twist, which Simon was referring to, I called...
It's pretty glaring.
About 10 minutes into the film.
It's not
really a surprise to anybody.
You just need to have seen some movies before this to know, oh, hey, that guy's suspicious.
Yeah.
And it's basically a very sleepy film that its sleepiness is at least justified for... You know, throughout the movie, but at least it's interesting in the first hour when you think that the film could go somewhere eventually once all the characters' cards are on the table and everyone knows who everyone is. Basically, when the police figure out, oh shit, there's another killer out there, and it's not the scissors guy, it's a copycat. So like, you expect the movie to get jump started at that point because the sleepiness of the film is justified by the fact that we're looking at the world. To an extent, through the eyes of a murderer, a guy that's like, he doesn't have normal emotions, he's just very placid, he's just walking around with a girl on his arm who's always like, what are we going to do now? I'm going to talk imperiously and not do anything.
Yeah, the series of this movie is just so fucking declamatory.
Yeah.
I admire Simon for hanging on as long as he did, but I gotta admit, this one lost me pretty quickly, and... because it just seemed like it wasn't going anywhere. And guess what? It didn't. It didn't go nowhere. It just sat around and was like, oh, yeah, hey, murderer. Yeah. Right. I should do something with this movie. Oh, here's a plot twist from a film you might have seen. And, oh, here's another plot twist that you saw coming. And, oh, wait, we ran out of plot. Fuck. Here's 20 minutes of psychobabble.
Yeah, the psychobabble in this is, like, all the worst, like, the laughable impulses of Psycho. The last scene where they're explaining how Norman Bates got to be Norman Bates.
Yeah, imagine that shit dragged out to a 20-minute climax.
And very serious. Like, it's stuff that trots out the Elektra Complex, which is, like, name-dropped twice before this point. And, like, the only reason why I was actually kind of interested in the twist cursorily was because I just momentarily forgot what the Elektra Complex was. And I was like, oh, yeah, it's a thing with, oh, a thing with the dead. And and so, like, it's very self-satisfied stuff that, like, culminates in this, like, ridiculously overheated image of the Scissors Man as, like, a Christ-like martyr.
Oh, my God.
Like, and that image is, like...
he's, like, standing there and with his arms out, and it has, like, five or six different overexposure things exposed over him.
Yeah, it's a cross, it's a scissors, it's a cross again, it's him. And it's, like, we get it. You open the film with a girl on a cross, and you're ending with him on a cross. And I just don't care. At that point, I'm totally like, fuck you. This movie is...
It was really, really bad, and... really, really boring. And after you understand what it's doing, you realize it doesn't have anything to say.
Yeah,
it's just it's sitting there and waiting to die. It's waiting until it can slink off into the night and never bother you again.
I will say this: the only thing, one of the reasons why I wanted to be invested in the film, theoretically at least, for the first hour, is because it's got kind of. The look of the film is actually kind of interesting. Everything is very flat but uniform. It's not like flavorless or anything. There's a lot of gray surfaces. There's a lot of office decor quality, mise-en-scene. There's a lot of stuff that, like, it's very clean. There's a lot of negative space. It's very interesting to look at in the sense that it's drab, but it's also very neat. And I like that. I like that sense of, like, it's gray and it's, you know, of course the world is gray in this film. But, like, it's also very, like, neat because that's, like, how a sociopath's mind works. It's, like, that kind of organizing principle that, like, leads them to murder because they need things to be just so. And that's kind of at least cursorily interesting. And movie's got two actors I like. The guy who plays the Scissors Man, whose name I don't remember, but if you've seen a bunch of contemporary Japanese films, you probably recognize him. And Hiroshi Abe, who plays a police profiler, Hiroshi Abe is in everything. He's in if you aren't even a cult fan, you probably at least have seen him in Hirokazu Koreeda's Still Walking. And if you are a cult film fan, you might know him as the guy in Survive Style 5 Plus, the hypnotist, or even I think he plays multiple roles in Funky Forest, and he's everywhere in cult films and in mainstream stuff. He's in the big Japanese blockbuster Japan Sinks. He's in Godzilla 2000. He's in the Thai film, martial arts film Chocolate. He's everywhere.
He pops up a lot, yeah.
And he's good. That's the thing. Like, if he were everywhere, it wouldn't be so remarkable. But he's actually a talented guy.
Yeah.
And he's a good actor, so that's fun. But everything else about the man behind the scissors is just that.
Yeah, you can pretty much glean what the film's after when you look at the title. It's, you know, we're going to expose the man behind the scissors.
Behind every man behind the scissors, yes. There's a good woman behind the scissors.
Behind the scissors. the last few Netflix grab bags that we've gone on at length about, this is not going to be one of those films. I think we've pretty much exhausted everything we have to say about it. So, to give you guys your money's worth, I'd like to read.
Yeah, we started while we were watching this movie, Exquisite Corpses because we were so bored. And we didn't miss anything. Trust me, we were watching it and writing, and we didn't miss a beat. But But we did write a fun exquisite corpse. Sources, and Steve is gonna do a dramatic reading of an excerpt from our story. Take it away, Steve.
Which excerpt would you like me to read?
Let's see.
Should I read about the owls or?
Let's go a whole page from middle of the page here. This part.
So start with
to the, here.
Start with Lee Marvin ain't nothing to fuck with.
Yeah, Lee Marvin ain't nothing to fuck with.
Lee start Marvin there. Ain't nothing to fuck with.
Yes.
Yet the Woo would and did fuck with him until the day he killed Method Man with a fork. This fork was smelted in a Guatemalan foundry in which 14 workers had fallen into a vat in 1942. These workers were never commemorated with a statue, but they did make for nice flatware. One of the flatware in question was the fork that Lee used to kill Meth. This was indeed deadly flatware. Why did it have to be flatware? Lee Marvin swore at no one in particular. Snakes, okay. Toshiro Mifune, fine. But flatware? Then Marvin realized he had no idea what flatware is. Some kind of shoes? Part of a floor? A fancy computer program? Yeah, that must be it. Must be a Windows thing. Fucking Windows! He yelled, his left eye twitching wildly. With these last words, Steve Jobs sank into the enormous vat of butterscotch pudding that he had specified as his final resting place. Aww. He left all his money to his maid. Her name was Raquel Welch, no relation. She took the money and became the world's second most successful rutabaga farmer, a title of which she was very proud. However, no matter how hard she tried, she could never surpass the great Orville Pig Dicker. What's the point? He will always be Orville Pig Dicker, and I will not! Cursed Lee Marvin, still in this story somehow. Then he ate another hot dog, and Paul Hogan showed up. Enter Crocodile Dundee.
I think that's a good place to stop.
And on that note, we will leave you hanging as to what happens to Crocodile Dundee.
It's a pretty awesome story. It's a lot of symmetry. It's a lot of hot dog eating on Lee Marvin's part.
The world explodes twice.
Oh, and Tom Savini eats a hot dog, too.
He intercepts a hot dog.
Intercept with his teeth.
With his teeth!
Anyway, so...
Yeah. Anyway, that's... So that's very much about the man behind the scissors.
Yeah. By the way, I'm sure somewhere out there, Tim and Eric are saying to themselves, damn, I wish we had those ideas. But, yeah. So, okay, as per usual procedure with the Netflix grab bag, we're now going to read four titles, and we're going to... Are we actually doing Netflix? Oh, yeah, we are, actually.
We're doing a Netflix grab bag. Yep.
And the thing with that is we're going to read four titles, and we're going to make them available on our site to vote through Poll Daddy. And this time we're taking them from the disc queue from Steve's list, and they're unusually arty, folks.
I was going to say, keep in mind, this is from my disc queue. Usually when things pop up in my queue, there's always, like, trauma films and shit like that. But we managed to pull together a relatively respectable batch of films this time, and I don't know quite how that happened, but...
La-di-da.
Yes. So, the first film is Blissfully Yours.
The Appy-Chat-Pong We Are the cool film.
Yes,
Did you like how I said that, folks?
The one of his films that I have yet to see, or at least the one of his
features.
I haven't caught really any of his shorts yet.
I've seen almost all of his shorts.
Yeah.
And they're all really of varying length, so I'm actually kind of proud of that, because the dude cranks them out, like...
I know he's pretty prolific.
But yeah, I've seen... I think I haven't seen two of his features, Blissfully Yours and Mysterious Object at Noon.
I caught Mysterious Object at Noon on the Sundance Channel a few years back. Huh. It's pretty fascinating.
He's generally a fascinating filmmaker, though.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to say it's on the level of, say, you know, Tropical Malady, but it's definitely...
Tropical Malady
is pretty fucking great, yeah.
And I really like Syndromes in a Century. I have a feeling if I were to rewatch that, I would like it even more, even though I think it's pretty terrific. But yeah, what's the next title?
The next title is La Chinoise.
La Chinoise! So, damn it!
I don't know how to fucking say it. Leave me alone.
It's Godard.
It's, yeah, the late 60s Godard feature. I believe this is the one where...
Mau Mau?
Yeah, a bunch of kids build a wall out of Little Red Books.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, it sounds good to me, because we both watched Film Socialism and both had that, like, revelation where it's like, wow, holy shit, Godard's still awesome, isn't he?
Yeah, it was... I was... If there was any film that came out commercially last year that I was looking forward to less than Film Socialism... I can't recall what they were, but yeah, I ended up being knocked on my ass by that one.
I was hesitant to approach it too, although I wouldn't say I was not looking forward to it. And then I watched it, and I was like, "Fuck! Why didn't I watch this sooner?" It's great.
Yeah, it was pretty awesome. The third film is one that speaking of films that I haven't been looking forward to, the third film is one I've had on my queue forever because I'm really dreading visiting it. But it's something that I keep there because I adore pretty much everything else the director has done. And that film is The Lovely Bones.
Woo! I watched the first 30 to 40 to 50 minutes of it, and it started to get bad when I turned it off.
Yeah, I fear I will not be able to shake Matt Pergé's immortal assessment of it as, why does heaven look like a fucking Lunesta ad?
It's unfortunate, but true.
And the fourth film is called Blame.
Shame on... Oh, sorry.
No, not Michael Fassbender.
Because I was doing...
I know you were doing a Wu-Tang Clan. Now I want to see Michael Fassbender sing...
Rapping?
Yes!
Fuck yeah! Oh, yeah.
It just hit, like... if in Shame, if he had gotten up there and punched, like, you know, Carrie Mulligan and grabbed the microphone from her.
Shame on the nigga that tried to run Blame. Yes.
Yeah, that would have made the movie so much better, wouldn't it?
I want to wake a pow. Cut the cord.
Awesome. Anyway. But, so the fourth film is Blame, which is part of a series of, I believe, television films made in Spain. Called The Six Films to Keep You Awake.
Yes.
And this particular entry was made by Narciso Ibáñez Serrador, who is best known in genre circles for his exemplary Who Can Kill a Child?
Yay!
Which is, if you haven't seen it, is pretty rough stuff. But
what?
Fascinating.
It's not rough stuff.
It's pretty nasty.
Oh, okay. Well, I thought you were saying it was hard to watch.
No. It's certainly got the courage of its convictions. And
oh, it's really good. It's
terrific.
And I remember watching that for the first Who Can Kill a Child for the first time on a double bill at Lincoln Center, actually, with Ravenous. And like I left that theater. And I was like,
what an incredible double feature!
It was great. Oh my god, cloud nine.
That's a terrific double feature.
And, shit, what was I saying? No, but yeah, like, I'm curious about this one because the only other time where I've thought of that film or that filmmaker in general was when Eli Roth was making a laundry list of all the people that influenced Hostel 2, which is probably doesn't have, like, has the meaningless honor of being Roth's best feature.
I wouldn't argue that. Yeah.
And there are a couple of scenes in the film, especially the plot with the children in Hostel 2, are directly influenced by Who Can Kill a Child.
That's very much a Who Can Kill a Child, sort of hat tip from Roth.
Sure.
Although with Roth, I'm not sure that he's gotten beyond... I'm not sure it's hat tip so much as wholesale lifting. But that's
well, he's copped to it, so I don't
that's,
know.
That's another discussion.
We rewatch it, and there's a line where he says, "I don't know who can kill a child." But yeah, what's our topic for next month, Steve?
Our topic for next month is a fun one. It's the dregs of the Happy Madison Production Company.
Oh fuck!
Yes.
Oh
yes.
Do we have any titles in mind already?
We're definitely doing Bucky Larson and Jack and Jill.
Jesus.
Yeah. The other two I haven't quite decided yet, but...
We're not doing Zookeeper, right?
Ooh.
I've already done that one!
Oh, okay.
I'm reviewing it!
Then we won't...
God damn it!
We won't do Zookeeper.
Thank you!
We might do Benchwarmers.
I don't know what that is.
Rob Schneider, John Hader, and David Spade, I believe.
That doesn't seem bad enough, though. You want something as bad as Zookeeper.
Yeah, well, you haven't talked to people who've seen Benchwarmers, have you?
I guess not.
There's also Without a Paddle.
I don't think that's... Does that have a bad reputation?
Yeah, that has an abysmal reputation.
I mean, I guess we consider it.
Grandma's Boy has too much of a following.
Yeah.
But yeah, so basically we're going to comb through the worst of the worst for Happy Madison. Because, as always, we do it because we hate ourselves.
And we love you.
And we love you, and we suffer for your entertainment. So, hopefully you're entertained.
Look, I will watch Zookeeper again since you haven't seen it, because you have to see Zookeeper.
No. Do I have to, really?
Nick Nolte as a gorilla who is obsessed with TGI Fridays. And several, like, and my favorite, one of my favorite inexplicable things about that film is Adam Sandler voices a monkey, and it sounds like George Burns had a seizure, or a stroke, sorry, a stroke, and he's like, he's just talking like this. And it's like, it's this ridiculous voice that you could totally see Adam Sandler one day went into the, like, the recording studio and was like, hey guys, I got a great idea for crazy monkey voice. What if I talk like this? And it's just like, oh my god, why are you doing that? Why are you doing that? Why are you doing that and doing that and doing that?
It's so
and much, that's the Happy Madison ethos, basically.
Basically, yeah. And for every tolerable film they have, there's a bunch of terrible, terrible, terrible films. And we're going to tackle them! Yeah!
Not even touch football. We're going to tackle
them. Oh, we're taking them right down. We're going to tackle them, and we're gonna try and penetrate those motherfuckers.
Oh,
It's not over until the butt rape lady sings. No. I'm just saying.
No.
All right. So for the Bad Idea Podcast, I'm Steve Carlson. He's Simon Abrams, and we're signing off.
Bye.